I whistle and my memory goes back. I'm alone in solitary confinement in a prison near the center of Cape Town, feeling desperate, determined to survive the solitary confinement. The security police have locked me up and they want information from me, and it's about the struggle against apartheid. It's 1963, and I'm trying to be brave, and I march in my tiny little cell, and I sing, and I whistle, and I whistle, and I sing. I can't see anything. I can't see outside, but I hear din, shouting, screaming, and I'm trying through music to keep myself with a sense of sanity and personality. And I'm whistling, and I'm trying to communicate. Is anybody else in the prison who's hearing me? Please, please respond. And I sing, and I whistle ANC songs, and Kosi Sikelel' Afrika, and there's no response. And the people's flag is deepest red. And I whistle, and there's no response. And then I go, I think I hear whistling from deep in the prison.
I would have been 16 years of age when our band director decided that the particular ensemble that he had that year was good enough to try to produce a serious piece of music. So he tried to introduce us to Dvorak's New World Symphony. It was something that none of us knew anything about. We made chaos out of our first attempts and had no concept of why this music would or could be beautiful. So on the third rehearsal, he paused and he proceeded to astonish us. And in retrospect, I'm still astonished by telling us about his struggles during the Great Depression, so in the 1930s, in New York City, where he, as a violist, was trying to find work, needing to have rent and food for his young family. Desperation, he went to a pawn shop where he turned in his viola and on impulse purchased a pistol, thinking that the only escape from this situation was to kill himself. When he walked by a concert hall with a poster board in front of it that said, "Free today, Dvorak's New World Symphony," he decided he would go in and sit far back and shoot himself, perhaps in the bathroom at an intermission, but he got captured by the music. By the last movement, he had decided to not kill himself, instead to go back to the pawn shop, turn in the gun and the bullets, and try to retrieve his viola in order to look for work again. So at the end of this story, he looked at us, who were completely stunned, and said to us, "Boys and girls, this music saved my life." Now, shall we try it again? And I really don't remember whether we did well with the rest of the rehearsal. I do remember and still feel the overwhelming sense of community that we had established with him and with the music. Perhaps with all people who have desperate times and recover, and with the notion of music as healing.
I never found out who it was until after I was out of the prison, but there was a human being, and it was through Dvořák, through the going home theme. Eventually we established a certain time. It was early evening when the screaming of the drunks and the others brought in was at its least. The doors weren't being slammed so much. We had the best chance of hearing each other, and that would be our music time. And the means of communication was the Dvořák.
When Dvořák came to America in 1892, he was very much at the height of his powers. He knew there were huge expectations of him as director of the conservatory in New York, and he was wanting to fulfil them as best he could. But once he got to New York, the sheer excitement of the Columbus celebrations of that year, he was caught up with all of that, his new teaching duties. He was handed a copy of Longfellow's Hiawatha by Mrs. Thurber, the person who'd invited him to New York to actually fulfil these obligations, and she was hoping for an opera, but he began really to concentrate on writing a symphony in the January of 1893. The Largo second movement of the symphony is, in a sense, the heart of it, and in many ways the most interesting in relation to his aspiration, maybe to write an opera or possibly a cantata on Hiawatha. He knew the poem very well. He'd read it possibly as early as 1870, you know, something like 22, 23 years before he came to New York, and it had gone into his psyche. It picks up on that kind of epic balladic tradition that he was very familiar with from Czech poetry, and the structure of that movement is so fascinating because it's not a conventional slow movement. It's a sequence of the most inspired lyrical episodes.
My name's Guy Otwell, and I had to do national service in the British Army, and I was sent to Libya. I was 19 or 20, and I'd never been so far away before, so I guess I had a bit of a culture shock arriving in an Arab country. And I was sent from Benghazi along to Derna, a little town on the sea coast. And somebody told me that there was a group of people who met to listen to music. They told me it was in a house down by the seafront on the Delta, and it was a sort of isolated house. I went up the garden path and went in and went upstairs to the room where people were sitting on chairs, and there was an old Maltese dental colonel. His name was Colonel Greg, and he was sitting on a chair at the front. And I remember the sight of the one lamp in the room, the light shining down on top of his bald brown head. And he said a few humble words, and then he started the record turning. And out came this stream of cool music. Mountains, waterfalls, forests, clouds, you know, seas, lighthouses. That's how it sounded to me. Like exploring into an unknown continent. I was just amazed. I probably never listened to music with such complete attention for so long a span in my life before or since. And it was Dvorak's New World Symphony. The Largo certainly has some of these wonderful themes in it. It does bring back memories of those first days abroad.
The decision to actually set it to Words Going Home by William Arms Fisher, almost as a kind of plantation song spiritual, was a very, very clever one. It was made in 1922, which is many years after Dvorak had died, and I suspect Fisher probably made rather more out of it than Dvorak did in his lifetime out of the symphony. But it was, in a sense, a kind of way of saying the symphony belongs to a tradition that is founded on the melodies of America. Going Home was taken up very, very quickly by a whole number of recording artists. Possibly the most iconic one in many ways is Paul Robeson, who, in a sense, spoke for disadvantaged black America. And I think, you know, there we have the clear connection between the spiritual and the protest song and the desire for peace and reconciliation of various kinds.
Not far, just close by, through an open door. Work all done, carried by, going to fear no more. Mother's there expecting me, father's waiting too. Lots of folks gathered there.
I'm Kath Marcangelo. I live in Whitehaven, and for the last 25 years I've been working as a professional singer, travelling all over the world with my husband John Marcangelo. We were flicking through the channels and found an old black and white film called The Snake Pit, starring Olivia de Havilland. And at the end of the film, the cast were inmates of an asylum, and they all started to sing the song Going Home, to the tune of Dvorak's New World Symphony. And John and I both sat up with a start. It was as if we'd been touched by something. It was very, very strange. John was writing a musical at the time called Clog Dance, which was loosely based upon the 1947 William Pitt disaster, which happened in Whitehaven, where 104 men and boys were tragically killed. But this Going Home was so haunting, the lyrics, that John arranged this as part of the musical. And it sang as Albert, the news of Albert, the young miner who'd gone in to rescue the others, had been killed. June the 2nd, 2010, I got the terrible news that Derek Bird had committed these dreadful shootings in and around Whitehaven. A local vicar contacted me and asked me if I would sing a song at the memorial service for the victims. And going home was the first thing that came to mind. I think the thing about this song that touches people's hearts is the sense of toil, life's toils and struggles, inevitably coming to an end, but that there's an open door and people that you've loved or instances in your life that have meant a great deal to you will be there to enrich you and you'll finally be at peace.
When I hear the slow movement, it is, for me, quite somber and dark. It perhaps is because I recall this story and how our conductor, who was a man who had taught all of us anything we knew about music, related to it. So it is in some sense for me sad and reaches into the soul deeply and makes me ache. As a physician who works in an HIV program in Africa, I know that there are many people who at one time or another have had dark times in their lives and desperate times, times in which they feel as though there is no escape except to leave this life. And so I think the music touches that and opens me up in a way that people might describe as empathic, ready to connect with this dark side. And I think that's what the first two movements of the piece do to me.
My name's Margaret Caldicott. My mother was Sheila Brown. She was born in Singapore, educated in England, and then returned to work to Singapore. In 1942, as Singapore was falling, she had to get on a boat with her mother to escape the Japanese who were coming down through Malaya. And they were on a ship called the Vinerbrook. The ship was sunk and she was shipwrecked on an island called Banka Island. The Japanese interned hundreds of women and children, and in all they were in six camps in 3.5 years. The younger women had to work very hard. They had to chop the wood and grow the vegetables, clean the lavatories, clean the drains, and all the time they were more and more starved, there was more and more illness. They were living in terrible conditions. The British had very few possessions, so life was very hard. At the same time, there was a wonderful missionary called Margaret Dryborough who started an English-speaking choir. For 2 years, they were able to remember songs and words, and so they gave concerts, they did variety shows, and then gradually they ran out of words, and one day Nora Chambers had this marvellous idea of a string quartet. Then they could sing classical music without any words. They could hum and do vowels. And so Nora Chambers and Margaret Dryborough got together and started to arrange music and harmonise it. And so the Largo was born. And there were 600 women and children in this camp. They came out of their huts and sat down, and these chords started of the Largo, very, very pianissimo, that were to be sung magically and eerily. And my mother wrote the staves for the music. There were about 8 to a part. There were 4 parts. There were 2 or 3 singers in each group who could read music. And while they were working it, they could teach the rest of the members of that part of the choir their parts. And then in the evenings, they came together and they sang and rehearsed. This piece was the first piece that they sang in their first concert in the fourth prison camp they were in. And they were not allowed to gather together in big groups. The Japanese didn't like it. And the choir sat under the little roofed area in the middle of the camp on their boxes because they were too weak to stand.
The main melody of the Largo, so famous the world over, is really unlike anything else he wrote in a symphony. It's vocal. It's hummable beyond belief. It's a melody you kind of know before you've even heard it. It's something that's in the air. This was music that was meant to be sung, that it has a soul which externalises things for all manner of people, and it can be all manner of sentiment in all manner of situations.
Both singers and the audience were overcome because they hadn't heard music for 2 years. So this was the first classical music they'd listened to. Some people didn't even like classical music, but they were just spellbound by it. And my mother said after the war that the music was free. It went out. They were stuck in this hellhole, but the music was free and went out into the sky. Them a reason to live. It was something outside the mud and the squalor. They could forget where they lived.
It was another 5 months before I was released. A couple of months after that, I'm now back in my practice as an advocate at the bar in Cape Town, that I heard that Dorothy Adams wants to come and see me. And she said she'd been locked up in that same prison with me, and she was the one who'd communicated with the whistling. She'd actually belonged to another anti-apartheid group. We didn't have anything in common except these two huge things. We were both against apartheid and that human contact through the music. Of years pass, I'm living in exile in England, and I get a message. Again, it's Dorothy, and she's there, and we meet, and it's kind of joyous in the sense that we are free now. We don't have to worry about being picked up any time of the day or night, being thrown into solitary confinement. We're sad that we're far from our home, but we're glad that we can get on with our lives and do useful work and try and bring closer the day when we get rid of apartheid in South Africa. She became a Quaker. She married Frank Williams. She became very integrated into life in England, became quite well known in the peace movement and Quaker circles. And I would see her from time to time. I went to Mozambique. I got blown up in Mozambique. I lost an arm, the side of an eye. I'm carried almost comatose, flew back to England, recovered slowly in the hospital in London. And who comes to see me But Dorothy, you know, she wrote to me after I got out of hospital, and she said she's about to retire now, and maybe she can help me with correspondence or anything, something like that. We meet again, and she's a bit older, a bit grayer, a bit older, I've lost an arm. But again, there's that bond, that very special, strong bond between us. And I say, Dorothy, I don't want you just to write some letters for me. I'm going to set up a constitutional study center. Please, please, please be my assistant. And she became my assistant there. And possibly the strongest moment of recommemoration of our whistling came about when the Young Vic Theatre put on a special performance of The Jail Diary of L.B. Sachs, which had been written for the Royal Shakespeare Company, an adaptation of my book of that name by David Edgar. And now they decided I'd been blown up, I'd lost an arm, the sight of an eye. They wanted to do something to help me reestablish myself in England. And the Young Vic put on the special performance, and four people who'd played L.B. Sachs at different stages took part in that play. And at the end, I hadn't been out of hospital very long, still pretty weak. I shuffled up onto the stage. This is such a theatrical occasion that I must be part and parcel of the theatricality of the moment. And I go up onto the stage and I say, thank you. I wish I could applaud, but I can't clap my hands. And I clap with my left hand, my surviving hand, my cheek, and people are crying, and I'm on the verge of tears. And I say that in the audience today is my mother, will she come up onto the stage, and also Dorothy Williams, the person to whom I whistled. And somehow that sense of the Dvorak, which features in the play Jail Diary of L.B. Sachs, and Dorothy being up on the stage there with me in this British theatre, somehow all of that came together in a supremely romantic and affirmative moment for me.